Atlantic to the Pacific, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. And don't forget, you can go to speakingofstrange.com for a live chat during the show, regular updates on weird news around the world, more information on topics discussed, and links to the official Haunted Asheville Ghost Tour, the Asheville Mystery Museum, Facebook page, Twitter, all that stuff. Visit hauntedasheville.com. And yes, we are continuing our tours and ghost hunts throughout the holiday season. It's hard to believe it's the holiday season already. Once Halloween ends, it's all nice and Christmassy. But, you know, you heard me say, perhaps last hour, that I recently spoke at the second Brown Mountain Lights Symposium in Morganton, North Carolina. It was a huge hit, a great success. Everybody had a wonderful time. The topic was, what does the government know? And, of course, I'm in the studio with producer Forrest Connor. We have investigator Shelley Wright of Wright's Coin Shop. And all three of us have a history with the Brown Mountain Lights, especially you and I, Forrest. We started camping up there, gosh, easily 15 years ago.
At least, yeah.
Yeah, and camping up there, bringing various scientists to Brown Mountain to camp with us, people like your father, John Connor. We brought a rocket scientist with us. We brought a physicist. We've brought forest rangers, all kinds of different people, gathering evidence. And, you know, for my program, I wanted to talk about why the government may actually have an interest in Brown Mountain. Of course, the Brown Mountain Lights, for those who do not know, are a phenomenon that occurs not too far from Morganton, about an hour's drive from where we are broadcasting here in Asheville. Brown Mountain is a long, low-lying ridge, and for at least 100 years, perhaps hundreds of years, these strange multicolored balls of light have appeared floating on and around the mountain at night. And we believe that most of these are a natural phenomenon similar to ball lightning. Well, how in the world does that apply to government interest? Well, I'm going to go down a list of scenarios here that may explain why that the government would be not only interested in Brown Mountain, but has eventually now become very protective of Brown Mountain, and has perhaps done some subversive things to protect the activity there, as weird as it sounds. A lot of people know that there's a mountain where you can go and see these inexplicable lights, but they haven't heard about the bizarre phantasmagoria of conspiratorial warp-like activity that occurs around Brown Mountain. People seeing ghosts, people seeing UFOs, people being abducted, people being taken into custody by strange men in black and other mysterious figures. We've all seen bits and pieces of this. Even you have, Shelley, which we'll get to at some point in this discussion, related to the National Geographic segment that we did a couple years ago on the Brown Mountain Lights. But here's what I can tell you in a very sort of bona fide, credible fashion here to demonstrate that the Brown Mountain Lights have truly been on the government's radar for at least a century now. And when we use the word government, you know, we're talking about a lot of different things. You know, government is a word that covers a lot of areas, a lot of little bodies that are kind of connected together in often loose fashions. So let's stick to some of the facts that are undeniable, that are not contested. we know the very first time the Brown Mountain Lights were featured in a public media form was an article in the Charlotte Observer that was printed in 1913. It was in September of 1913. An article which you can probably find with relative ease online, talking about hunters and people like that seeing these big, often reddish balls of light around the mountain. So again, that was 1913. Well, that very same year, 1913, the USGS, that is to say the U.S. Geological Survey, sent a scientist to study the phenomenon. His name was D.B. Stewart. And he spent a little time around Morganton. He observed for a while, and he decided that these were most likely the product of train lights, locomotive lights, that were just being seen reflecting here and there and confusing people. The problem is, 3 years later, in 1916, a massive flood hit western North Carolina, killed a lot of people around here. It wiped out all locomotive access to that area for a long time, and yet the lights still continued, not just as brightly as ever, but even more brightly in many cases. So obviously, D.B. Stewart's explanation was not sufficient. Then we fast forward to the year 1919. That's when the Smithsonian and what was then called the U.S. Weather Bureau, which we now call the National Weather Service, the Smithsonian and the U.S. Weather Bureau worked together, and they sent a scientist to study the lights. His name was Dr. W.J. Humphreys. And Humphreys, he didn't have a good explanation. I mean, he looked at this, and he said it reminded him of some similar spook lights that he had heard about in the Andes Mountains of South America, called simply the Andes Lights, which were still unexplained, and as far as we know, are still unexplained. So he was, you know, open to the idea that, you know, it has a connection to something else that we know of, but can't explain it. And then in 1922, the U.S. Geological Survey sent another scientist named George Mansfeld, and he wrote a very famous report called Circular 646, in which he kind of said, well, maybe a certain percentage are brush fires, and a certain percentage are star reflections, and a certain percentage are, you know, campers, and he just kind of had this real wishy-washy ad hoc, kind of like a weatherman. And the percentage of this, percentage of that, nothing definitive. And again, that was 1922. Well, these types of sort of little government-oriented investigations continued. It takes us all the way up to the 1970s. From 1977 to 1987, a group of scientists from the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Tennessee, they formed a group called Orion, which stands for the Oak Ridge Isochronous Observation Network. And for a 10-year period there, they camped quite a bit, and one of the scientists who worked on that project, Dr. David Hackett, even camped with us on Brown Mountain, I think, on a couple occasions for us. And Dr. Hackett said that they did all kinds of experiments. They used spectroscopes. They even set off some dynamite charges at one point on the mountain and were able to trigger some lights when the mountain shook. And he and his group had pretty much come to the conclusion that these are plasmas, same as we have concluded. And if you don't know what a plasma is, let me just sort of briefly explain. If you take something like a solid, we'll say a chunk of ice, it's a solid because the molecules are rather close together. You add a little energy in the form of heat, for example, and the molecules spread out and it becomes looser, and now we have something like a liquid. And you add a little more energy and the molecules spread even farther apart, and now you have a gas. But if you add even more energy at that point, something remarkable happens. At least one or more electrons are literally ripped out of each of the atoms, and now you have this free-floating luminous mass of electrons and atoms which now have a positive charge because they're missing some electrons. And this is what we call a plasma, the fourth state of matter. It's not like blood plasma. We're talking about physics plasma. Now, I know that may sound a little complicated, but actually a lot of things that you're familiar with exist in the plasma state. A typical lightning strike is a form of plasma. The sun exists largely as a plasma. Even a simple candle flame is a form of plasma. I mean, think about it. You look at a candle flame, what is it? It's not a liquid, it's not a solid, not a gas. It's a plasma, right? So this is a very legitimate explanation for a form of strange luminous phenomena. The biggest question always was, how does it form these balls like ball lightning? And we think we have some insight on that. But nonetheless, right around this same period of time, in the 70s and 80s, the reports coming from Brown Mountain researchers started to take a weird twist. A lot of the people who were up there were being monitored. They were seeing government activity. They were being harassed. In fact, in the 1980s, a lot of military training began on and around Brown Mountain. Now, this is a fact. We don't know exactly what kind of training they're doing, but I remember clearly talking to a guy years ago who told me he owned a cafe in Morganton, and one day a full bird colonel came in and basically negotiated a contract for this cafe to feed about 400 men every day for a month or two on Brown Mountain. And it was a big project, but it was a lucrative deal. So every day, this guy in Morganton with the cafe would load up a truck with all kinds of food, take it up to a service road gate where they would meet a couple of MPs. The MPs would take possession of the food. They'd sign off on it, and then, you know, it was gone into the forest. And the cafe owner never saw all these 400 men who were being fed. You know, why were there so many men up there? What were they doing? We're going to take a break here. When we come back, you'll see how much more bizarre and dark and twisted some of these reports about government interest and government involvement with Brown Mountain has continued to swell over the years, and how that it involves men in black. And ultimately, I'm going to give you my conspiracy theory as to why that the government has now become so involved with the Brown Mountain Lights. And I think that it has applications for a lot of what we think of as paranormal phenomena. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. We'll continue right after this on Speaking of Strange.
Way out on old Linville Mountain, where the Bear and the Catamount range, there a strange ghostly light can be seen every night, which no scientist or hunter can explain. In the mountains of North Carolina near Linville, there exists a strange phenomenon called the Brown Mountain Lights. On a clear night, these lights will appear and move about in a ghost-like manner on the mountaintop and down in the valley. These lights have been observed since the early days of the covered wagon, and to this day, no one can explain their mystery. Even scientists who come from various parts of the world can offer no solution. Uncle Fate Wiseman, who spent his entire 80 years in these mountains, used to tell this story, which to me could be as true as any other tale ever told, about the legend of the Brown Mountain Lights. In the days of the old covered wagon, when they camped on the flat for the night, with the stars growing dim on the old high gorge rim, they'd watch for that brown mountain light. High on the mountain, then down in the canyon below, it shines like the crown of an angel and fades as mist comes and goes. Way, way, way. slave, come back from the grave. But he's searching, searching, searching for his master who's long, long gone. Long years ago, a southern planter came hunting in this wild land alone. And here, so they say, the hunter lost his way and never returned to his home. But his trusty old slave brought a lantern, and he searched, but in vain, day and night. Now the old slave is gone, but his spirit wanders on, and the old lantern still casts its light. Well, high on the mountain, then down in the canyon below, it shines like the crown of an angel, and fades as the mist comes and goes. Way, way over yonder, night after night until dawn, will a faithful old slave come back from the grave? While he's searching, searching, searching for his master who's long, long gone.
You're listening to Speaking of Strange. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren, and that is the classic Brown Mountain Lights song by Tommy Fail. Became a big hit in the 1950s, was performed numerous times at the Grand Ole Opry. And a lot of people think of the Brown Mountain Lights, and they think of that legend recounted in that bluegrass song. I am Joshua P. Warren, and heck, I've spent a good 20 years investigating the Brown Mountain Lights. Forrest Connor has also done the same. And Shelley Wright, you went up there for the first time about 4 years ago, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And even you have already seen some pretty weird stuff. Before the break, I was talking about the fact that in the 1980s, there was some military activity taking place up there. We know that there is a lot of military training in North Carolina in general. I mean, look at Fort Bragg, for example. I mean, they're into all kinds of high-level training there. But I find it intriguing that there is this big pickup in the late 70s, early 80s, of military presence around Brown Mountain. And in 1983, when President Reagan was in office, they finally announced the Strategic Defense Initiative, which we call the Star Wars program. The Star Wars program was a huge effort by the United States to basically build something along the lines of a missile defense system. And that's when tensions, you know, were still pretty high with the Soviet Union. And prior to that, the policy was what they called MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. That's how they kept the peace. If you nuke us, we're going to nuke you. That was the way that they kept order. And Star Wars tried to bring a superior technology in. And if you are protecting or attempting to protect major areas of our geography here, the amount of power, the understanding of how the Earth itself works, about how the ionosphere is composed, all these things become very, very important. And I think it's very possible that some of the work done around Brown Mountain, because Brown Mountain is a natural conduit for a lot of energy, may have had a connection to the Star Wars program. During that period of time, this would have been early 80s, I have a friend, I will call him Bob, he does not want his real name to be used, and Bob, with several of his friends, went up to Brown Mountain. They'd been going up there for years and investigating the lights, and he said one day they came out off the mountain and suddenly a huge group of black sedans and law enforcement cars pulled up, didn't really say much of anything to them, just came over, took them into custody, took them off to an office where they were interrogated about why they were interested in the lights. they had a lot of equipment, telescopes and things that were worth thousands of dollars. All that was confiscated. They never got that back. They sat in a jail cell for a good 8 hours, and during that period of time, they heard these agents murmur on a number of occasions about talking to somebody in Washington. And when these men were finally released and threatened to stay away or else, my friend Bob went back to his apartment and it had been ransacked. And he had been investigating paranormal stuff since the 1960s, and he had one big cabinet that held a lot of his files on the paranormal. Everything from, you know, Bigfoot to big cat sightings, ghosts, all that was gone. He said that was, to him, priceless research, and all the valuable stuff in his house was left alone. All the paranormal stuff was gone. It scared him so bad, he never went back up there, and to this day, again, he doesn't like discussing this. He said nothing ever showed up on his permanent record, as far as he knows. But he was one of those guys who had had a close encounter with one of the lights at one point. A light came right up to him, and he actually felt he had a missing time experience. So if we fast forward up to around 1992, when I began very seriously looking into the Brown Mountain Lights, the first thing I started to hear when I would interview people or get kind of folklore collections, urban pop culture myths, was that there was some connection to caves. Caves would come up again and again and again. One of the first stories I heard came from a Citizen Times reporter who had written an article about the Brown Mountain Lights, and he put the word out that he was interested in explanations. And he was contacted by an old man who claimed that as a boy, the old man grew up around Brown Mountain, and one day he discovered a cave that he crawled into, and he saw a light back in the cave. And once he got close to the light, he was sort of shocked and disgusted to find the light was emanating from a large, writhing pile of worms. And he had eventually concluded that these worms were producing some kind of a gas that was becoming spontaneously ignited and creating lights. So, you know, worms with flaming blowholes, is this a viable theory? Maybe, but that was one of the first I heard. And then I started hearing stories from people who claimed there'd been uranium mining on Brown Mountain and that there were a number of holes and caves that you could find. You had to be careful. You'd fall into and, you know, break your leg or die. And, in fact, Forrest, when we were up there, we did find a number of holes on the mountain.
We did, and there seemed to be, like, water running
underneath
these holes. Like, there's almost like an underground creek or water system going on there.
That's right. You'd be walking along, and sure enough, if you didn't see that, you could break your leg easily stepping into it.
Actually, me and another researcher actually went back up there one afternoon after we'd been camping that weekend and actually collected some samples of that water.
That's, you sure did.
And what I understand, I think we had them analyzed, and it was like, there's very high mineral content in them.
Yeah, it made a great electrolyte for conducting electricity, building up charges flowing through the mountain. And then, of course, one thing I find also intriguing is that in around 1990, there was a book published called Underground Alien Bases by Commander X. And our friend Tim Beckley owns the company that published that book. And it told the story of a large base within Brown Mountain and of this man, Ralph Lael, who in the 1960s and 70s owned a little shop at Brown Mountain called the Outer Space Rock Shop Museum. And Lael said he was being abducted by aliens. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I will tell you about these alien abductions and about the alien mummy that Ralph Lael supposedly kept in the back room of his shop. It's a heck of a story. We're talking about the Brown Mountain Lights and conspiracies. What does the government know? I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
¶¶ sleeves I stained red from all the truth that I've said. And by it honestly, I swear, I just saw me wink. No, I've been on the brink. So tell me what you want to hear.
You are listening to Speaking of Strange, the show where the unusual becomes usual. We're talking about the Brown Mountain Lights and conspiracies related. What does the government know? Ralph Lill was a man who owned a shop around Brown Mountain. And you know, everybody I've talked to who met Ralph Lill said he actually came across as a very intelligent, stable, warm, friendly guy. I've never talked to one person who said he seemed like he was just nuts, you know. And Ralph Lill said he found a crystal cave one day. And actually, I think how it happened was he was blinking lights at the Brown Mountain Lights, and they were blinking back. And he sort of worked out a Morse code type deal, and they guided him to a crystal cave. He went inside. He found aliens. And one of them was a very, well, appeared to be a very attractive woman in bra and panties named Noma. And so perhaps that's why he volunteered to go with them. I don't know if you call that an abduction or not. And so they took him off to the planet PWAM, and they showed him various videos, for lack of a better word, of how life was seeded onto Earth and how we were going to destroy ourselves, typical doomsday type stuff. And people who knew Ralph Lill, they've told me that, sure enough, Lill, he would up and say, I'm going to go see the space people, and he'd walk off into the woods with a small packed lunch, and he'd be gone for 2 weeks. And then he'd come walking out of the woods, and he looked just as fresh and as clean as the day he left. So anyway, if you paid him a few bucks, he'd take you in the back of his outer space rock shop museum, and there he would show you a small mummified body that he sort of implied was an alien. Other people have said he admitted that this was something else. I mean, one person says he claimed it was the corpse of a child that he'd smuggled in from some other country. I don't know. But but either way, there are only two photographs of this alien known to exist. One was taken by Timothy Green Beckley. The other was taken by photographer Charles Braswell's mother, and I met her. So I now have met 100% of the people who photographed Ralph Lill's mummy. And a small, you know, dark-skinned, sort of shriveled-looking figure with a loincloth. And the mummy, well, the funny thing is, one day Ralph Lill disappeared. I've heard he supposedly killed himself. And somebody came in and bulldozed the shop to the ground. I talked to a guy at the symposium who said one day it was there, the next day it was gone. And nobody knows what happened to this little alien body. So, that said, as I mentioned earlier in the show, Lauren Warren has created a replica of this alien mummy, which you can now see if you visit the Asheville Mystery Museum. Also, I think we'll maybe put a copy of Timothy Green Beckley's photograph up at speakingofstrange.com. Tim gives me permission to put it on the website. So anyway, another cave connection. Well, then I talked to a hunter who said that he was up there hunting one day, and all of a sudden he was back on a trail in the middle of nowhere, and he said this Humvee appeared and almost ran him over, went blazing by, and then the Humvee disappeared. And he said it looked like it had come perhaps out of the ground and gone back into the ground, that it didn't fly away, it didn't vaporize. And then I talked to another hunter who said that he had been back in the woods. He was walking off hunting, that he was heading down a trail, and he looked over, and this was when it was in the afternoon, and in a green meadow next to him, he saw something shiny glinting in the grass. And once he made his way over to that spot, he couldn't see the shine, but in its place was a deep hole about the size of a half dollar. And in fact, he took a twig and dropped it in the hole, and it disappeared. And he wondered, what the heck is this hole here, right? So he went off and he continued hunting. Now, mind you, keep in the back of your mind, certain plasmas during when they are in sunlight will reflect, they will shine. So the hunter comes walking back that evening, it's getting dusky, and he notices that around the same area where he had seen this hole and the shiny glinting, there were now a semicircle of large sort of dark-colored SUVs parked. And they had their headlights on, all sort of focused on that one little spot. And he saw the silhouette of men's forms sort of breaking the beams of the headlights. And he thought, well, I'm going to go over there and see what's going on. So the hunter goes walking over to the site, and he said he got halfway there, and all of a sudden he heard the most god-awful, terrifying racket he'd ever heard in his life. It sounded like at least three or four men had opened up with automatic machine gun fire at that spot on the ground. The hunter hit the deck, and he, as soon as he got an opportunity, turned right around and scrambled out of there and said he had no idea who these men were or why they were shooting at that spot. Okay, see how weird these stories get? Well, now, what I can tell you is that I have been pulled over on a number of occasions at Brown Mountain, or on my way to Brown Mountain, and detained without explanation. Sometimes they just say, well, your vehicle matched the description of another vehicle that we were looking for, and they eyeball everything you have in the car. We've been observed by a lot of weird people, but one of the oddest scenarios was when I was there, I think it was about 2 years ago, when we were doing this shoot for the National Geographic Channel. And Forrest, you were there. Shelley, you were there. A number of our friends were there. Your father was there.
2009.
Was it 2009? Okay, so 3 years ago then, over 3 years ago. And so we were standing at the gravel parking lot of Wiseman's View, which is a very remote place, about to, you know, we were gathering our equipment, and we were about to walk down the trail and divide into our stations to start observing. And all of a sudden, this sort of a white Jeep just came tearing through the parking lot, just spinning and spraying gravel all over the place, zoomed right up next to us. There was a guy in the passenger seat who's snapping pictures. Looked to be another guy there with a video camera. We all stood there and looked at him like, what the hell are you doing, you know? And then hit the gas, and they tore off out of there again. Well, as soon as they started to tear off, I realized that there was a logo of some kind on this Jeep that looked official. So I went running after it, and I saw the logo said Commonwealth of Kentucky. And I could not figure out why the heck Commonwealth of Kentucky had any connection to anything we were doing. I mean, this is such a strange situation. Later, I was talking about this event on Coast to Coast AM, and a woman contacted me, a listener, and she said, well, you know, I live near Mammoth Cave, Kentucky, which I believe is the largest cave system in the world, isn't it, Farah?
It is.
And she said, the government has all kinds of facilities under Mammoth Cave, and they have the best experts and engineers related to subterranean structures. That's the headquarters, and that it would make sense that if there is a cave around Brown Mountain, that guys from Kentucky would be down there working in some capacity on it. People see all kinds of weird stuff at Brown Mountain. I mean, there have been occasions when we have walked in the middle of the night onto a piece of property, and there is such an eerie quiet and stillness, and there's a bluish glow to everything around you, and you almost feel like you're in the middle of a dream. And then you have people who see Pumpkin Man up there. Pumpkin Man is this shriveled little creature with wispy limbs who appears and scares people to death, and you wonder, could this possibly be real?
Well, I hear there's a guy that's in law enforcement that actually had an experience firsthand with Pumpkin Man.
Oh, really? Oh, I know you're talking about. You're right. He did have an experience firsthand, physical contact.
Right.
And, you know, we've talked about Michael Persinger. He is a researcher who has demonstrated that when the human brain is subjected to certain pulsations of electromagnetic energy, it can create experiences in subjects of being paranoid, of seeing lights, of feeling like they're being abducted, of experiencing ghosts. These are all things that can happen either because it opens up some perception in the brain or it causes people to hallucinate. We don't know cause and effect. Could it be that all these things, and I could go on and on, are leading more and more to the idea of some kind of an objective plasma energy field around Brown Mountain? Well, let me tell you something. Compasses spin when pilots fly around. People have seen what they think are strange Aurora spy plane contrails. When we come back from this break, I'm going to give you, ultimately, my theory here on why the government is so interested in Brown Mountain and in the Brown Mountain lights. We know these things are plasmas. We've measured the interference that comes from them when they manifest. We've videotaped them. We've talked to people who have touched the lights. We have been commended by the Navy Physics Lab. I even worked with a man on plasma projects. And I'm going to finally bring it all together, connect those dots when we return. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
Appreciate you. Let's find love while we may. Because I know I'll hate you when you are old and gray. So say you love me here and now. I'll make the most of that. Say you love and trust me, for I know you'll disgust me when you're old and getting fat. An awful debility, a lessened utility, a loss of mobility is a strong possibility. In all probability, I'll lose my virility, and you your fertility and desirability. And this liability of total sterility will lead to hostility and a sense of futility. So let's act with agility while we still have facility, for we'll soon reach senility and lose the ability. Your teeth will start to go, dear. Your waist will start to spread. In 20 years or so, dear, I'll wish that you were dead. I'll never love you then at all the way I do today. So please remember, when I leave in December, I told you so in May.
Holidays, everybody! Kicking off the season, season's greetings. Our old friend Tom Lehrer. That's how we all feel when we get into the Christmas spirit, right? Welcome back. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren in the final minutes of hour number two on tonight's program. And, you know, at Brown Mountain, we have seen again and again and again that there is indeed plenty of evidence for some type of plasma manifestation taking place on and around the mountain. And, you know, I know for a fact, having worked on projects related to plasmas and having known a man very well who was a NASA scientist who worked with plasmas, that the U.S. government has a great deal of interest in plasma technology. I have seen quite a bit of information that maybe I shouldn't have seen, but I did. And, you know, if you consider that we pick up the interference, sometimes people get sick when the lights appear. Shelley, you've had that experience of getting sick sometimes up there.
Yes.
If you start looking at plasma as a force of technology, then you must realize that we are already using plasmas every day. We use plasma technology to create torches, to create screens on various devices. We use plasma to create ion thrusters. We use it for rocket exhaust research. We already delve deeply into plasma for, you know, microprocessing technology. And that's plasma on a relatively small scale. If you had access to plasma on a large scale and you were able to channel the power of big plasmas, then you could create almost unfathomable lethal and non-lethal weaponry, incredibly efficient wireless communication technology, amazing propulsion and transportation devices. These are all things that would be of enormous interest to the U.S. military and the U.S. infrastructure in general. And do you know what? At a place which naturally produces this amount of energy, you would also have other weirdness triggered as a byproduct. People would see strange things. They would perceive ghosts more. They would perceive aliens more. They would have odd, warp-like experiences, similar to those attributed to the Bermuda Triangle. It may be because it changes the way the brain perceives things, or it may be that since we know the physical world is all relative, that the extra energy can sort of enhance various vibrations so that what is usually physical overlaps a little bit more with that which is usually non-physical and gives us these temporary limited glimpses and interactions with these other strange realms. Ultimately, if you ask the question, what's the government know? Well, let me tell you, the government would be and is interested in the Brown Mountain Lights for the very same reasons that we are. Because they know that this is a very special place. It's a natural laboratory for high-energy plasma production, which influences the way that we view physical science, the way we view quantum science, the way we view the mind-body-environment relationship. And Brown Mountain, therefore, is ultimately one of Earth's natural conduits for extreme energy. And extreme energy equals power. It's that simple. The government is harnessing as much knowledge as they can from places like Brown Mountain. And if you look at the Hestelen lights in Norway, which are a very similar phenomenon, those lights take place in a valley as opposed to the Brown Mountain lights that take place on high ground, and yet the scientists in Norway are much more open and serious about their research. We know they've spent at least $700,000 of taxpayer money looking into the Hestelen lights. And what have they concluded? The same thing. These are plasmas, and they are of great potential use for so many applications with the military and other government bodies. And that is why it's protected. That's why there's a conspiracy. That's what the government knows. We're going to take a break. When we come back, it will be the Dark 30 hour, not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended. It's when we dig into the more outrageous and controversial stuff and see just how dark and twisted the world really is getting. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange.